You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Another day is here and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America N.A., member FDIC.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. When you need energy on the go and don't have time to wait in line, grab Espresso Monster. Espresso Monster is a premium blend of espresso and cream made with freshly brewed espresso coffee, hormone-free milk, and a unique energy blend complete with taurine and B vitamins. Each can has 3 shots of espresso and comes in vanilla espresso and espresso and cream flavors. I had one this morning before I came into the studio, and let me tell you, it gave me just the boost I needed to get my day going. Plus, it tastes so delicious, I'd drink it anyway. So close your eyes, take a sip, and enjoy Espresso Monster today. And now, enjoy the podcast.
Okay, so are you ready to show and tell, baby?
Oh, yeah, Small Business Saturday.
We're, like, really doing it up this year.
It is so important to support local businesses.
I didn't go to Lowe's. I didn't go to Home Depot. I didn't go to Hardware Town, USA. I went to my local Zev's hardware store, and I got this hose. Because one day, I'm going to be one of those fancy people that has that wide selection of, like, dope plant life on my fire escape. And when I am, I'm going to use this hose to keep those bad boys alive.
Genius, inspiring, and good for the world.
Thank you.
We are really participating in our community.
Oh. Total.
And you know what? All this small business shopping, we earned Cyber Monday.
Oh, I cannot wait to just go like this.
Boop. God, I miss Amazon. Just scrolling, you know? It brings my heart rate down.
How much do you think this hose is if I bought it on Amazon? It's not like a local made hose.
That's right. Right? And it's like I'm buying something local and yet it was like made somewhere else. You know what I mean?
Hi, I'm Ben Mathis. Welcome to Kick-Ass News. That was a clip from the hit Comedy Central show Broad City. It was created by Alana Wexler and Abby Jacobson, who also write, produce, and star in the series. The two met as struggling improv performers at New York City's Upright Citizens Brigade and originally started Broad City as a web series for YouTube. Then fellow UCB alum Amy Poehler helped them develop and sell the show to Comedy Central, where it's now entering its 5th season and remains a favorite of the critics who hail Broad City as, quote, sneak attack feminism. Needless to say, it's been a wild journey for the two creators, and today Abby Jacobson comes on the podcast to talk about that journey and another more literal journey, a 3-week cross-country road trip that inspired her to write a new book called I Might Regret This. Essays, drawings, vulnerabilities, and other stuff. Today, Abby opens up about the frustrations of development hell, being a boss as a woman, and playing herself on TV. She shares how she and Alana got Amy Poehler to champion Broad City for television, the exec who turned down Broad City for being, quote, too girly, and what she says you can learn about a TV network from the snack offerings in the lobby. She reveals how she and Alana convinced Hillary Clinton to guest star on Broad City in the middle of the 2016 election and then had to deal with angry tweets from Bernie supporters. She discusses her ongoing struggle with work-life balance, why it took a book deal just to make her take 3 weeks off to travel the country and get over a broken heart, and how that trip taught her that the things we're most afraid of are the things that will most change us. Plus, aura readings in Sedona, feeling a little out of place at a Mormon lodge in Utah, and why a bed and breakfast is the worst place to go when you just want to be alone. Coming up with Broad City's Abby Jacobson in just a moment. Abby Jacobson is co-creator, executive producer, and co-star of Comedy Central's critically acclaimed hit show Broad City. She is the New York Times best-selling author of the illustrated book Carry This Book and has also created two coloring books, Color This Book, New York City, and Color This Book, San Francisco. On top of that, Abby is the host of A Piece of Work, the Webby Award-winning podcast from the Museum of Modern Art and WNYC Studios. And now she writes about road tripping and soul searching in a new book titled I Might Regret This, Essays, Drawings, Vulnerabilities, and Other Stuff. Abby, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, thanks for having me.
I enjoyed the book very much. And I have to say, I only came to Broad City very late in the game. I'm the person who always discovers the hottest show when it's over or on the final season. Breaking Bad, I didn't even begin to watch it until after the finale. Same with Game of Thrones. I just got into Game of Thrones, literally when they announced the final season. So it was the same thing with Broad City. I'm a little late to the game, but I love it.
Well, thank you. I think sometimes it's better. Like, obviously, I would have loved if you had watched it from the beginning, but it's better because you can binge shows like that. Mm-hmm. If you find out later, then it's like, oh, I can watch the whole season. Whereas, right. I was watching Breaking Bad episode, and it was like, you're like waiting for the next suspense. Episode. You can find out what happens.
Yeah. And I love that the more I read about the origins of the show, I guess, and you talk about this in the book, that you weren't getting anywhere with improv at UCB. They weren't putting you on the, what are they called? The Herald teams?
Yep, the house
and
teams.
And so you had to kind of do your own thing. And only then did UCB take notice of you and Alana.
Yeah. The I think it's the longest chapter in the book is about Broad City and how Alana and I began and sort of why it's ending. And yeah, it was this thing. And you know, web series are in abundance now. But mm-hmm. when we started it in 2009, they were not. But it was, it was completely out of us realizing we had to create our own material if we were ever going to be in this business at all. Because we couldn't find work elsewhere. Like, no one would put us in anything. No one would cast us.
Yeah, and it's just great that you can do that now with YouTube or podcasts or whatever. You don't have to wait for the gatekeepers to suddenly anoint you.
Exactly.
And eventually you got picked up for television. You talk about that process in the book, going through development hell. I guess you didn't start out at Comedy Central at first, right?
We started out at FX and developed there for a year and then ended up at Comedy Central.
You developed the show for, a year there with Amy Poehler at FX and then some new exec comes in, and what did he tell you?
Well, it wasn't a new exec, actually. Oh, okay. It was, so Amy's an executive producer of the show, and we asked her to be that after we were finishing up the web series, and she was in the last one. And we, Alana and I were like, we're going to go and try and pitch this, which is crazy. You know, I don't know anyone that is in television or has made a show, but we were like, let's go to LA and do this. And then Amy was in it in the episode, and we're like, let's ask her if she would ever want to be an executive producer, which was nuts. And then she said yes, and it was
that's incredible.
It was really incredible. And then so we went out to LA now with Amy and pitched it all over the place, and we ended up landing at FX with just a script commitment, and we developed that script for a year, and we thought it was going really well. And then after the end of that year, we found out they passed, and they felt it was too girly of a script. And at the time, I guess that was an okay thing to say.
Yeah,
now
this
maybe
was what,
it's not
2010 or something.
It's 2011.
2011. Okay.
And I'm not like, you know what? It is. Feminine.
Well, the title is Broad City.
And that's not a negative, but I guess FX is predominantly more masculine. That's just what it's like. Yeah. And then, I'm so happy that that happened because Comedy Central is definitely, without a doubt, the right home for it. And they just got it in a different way. And we've been there ever since.
You sum up the development process perfectly, better than anyone I've ever known.
Wow. Okay.
You say that it's development for development's sake, all for an audience of one. That is
exactly what it is. Like, and you know, since Broad City's been there, I've been working on a number of other projects as a producer, and I found that this is how it is, where it's like this pyramid of development people that are really excited about projects, but then it gets to the top and there are these execs that aren't as involved in the process.
Yeah.
And then they're just not into it.
Yeah.
And it's like, what's happening? and it's just this cycle of like, I know people that are development execs that have never gotten anything made. Like not at studios, but they're like at production companies. They're just producing and developing shows, and then they never get made. But it's like how the industry runs.
Yeah, it's like Office Space or something. Where it's like the employee who just wants to look like he's working, but he's really not working.
Yeah, but like they are working. Like they're trying, but they're not producing. Money going into it, but then it's like not ever on the air.
Yeah.
It's just very interesting.
Yeah, it's just so bizarre. And at one point in your book, you rate the TV network lobbies and snack offerings.
It's so interesting looking back on that because, you know, I am writing about snacks, but I was trying to write, there's a couple chapters in my book that are weirdly about food, but they're not. Like snacks measuring who we are, you know? So I go into the studio or the network's kitchens or lobbies and sort of figure out who they are based on what kind of snacks and ambiance they present you with, which is how I think you can tell a lot about someone or place.
Well, yeah.
How they're presenting themselves.
So what does that say about some of these networks? For instance, FX versus Comedy Central or a network like NBC?
I think the HBO lobby says the most, which is like there's nothing offered to you.
Yeah, it's very, I don't want to call it sterile, but like there's not much there.
I mean, it's like, it's very artful in there. It's like sculptural and like it's very well designed, but it's not friendly or welcoming.
Yeah.
In a way that is a little bit, dare I say, intimidating.
Yeah.
But also, as I wrote, it's like they can do that.
Oh, yeah.
They are the place where they don't need to like give you snacks and like be like, you know, come on. Like they don't need to impress anyone because most people want to be there.
Yeah.
Whereas a lot of the other networks, not that they need to be as inviting, but they just are, their persona is more friendly.
Yeah.
And is more like, what can we get you? You know, it's a different vibe.
Yeah. Yeah. It's more of a startup vibe.
Exactly. All the networks, which I say in the book are very similar lobbies. Like you can't really differentiate them other than the posters on the wall are very bright and glossy and like, just like the shows they are.
How about my snacks? I offer you coffee,
Coke. Really good. You have a good snack.
I don't know if you browsed the snack basket.
I did. You have a great snack basket.
Okay. I try to be a good host.
You do. Like, it is a great host, and it's just you, and it's impressive.
And I'm trying to have more healthy snacks because I have a ton of chocolate and a ton of candy and chips and stuff like that. And my wife has always come in, and there's nothing to eat. And so I have some kind of seaweed stuff in there.
I think it's a great
selection. I'm trying to expand.
You did not even need to have snacks because your situation is like, I wouldn't eat a snack because because people are talking.
Oh, okay.
So they like can't.
Yeah, snack. Yeah. You know, I told you that I'm a new convert to Broad City. And I read after I started getting into it, you received all kinds of praise from critics. And the Wall Street Journal in one review called it sneak attack feminism. When you started this originally as the YouTube series, were you and Alana conscious of any kind of intent to embed Broad City with a feminist message? Or how did that happen?
So I will say that quote, and I don't really remember any other quotes of press, that is a quote about the web series. By this woman, Megan Angelo, who is awesome and was this New York, I think she might live out here now, a New York writer. And at the time she was like writing all over, but she did this piece for the Wall Street Journal, I believe about the web series. Because we were so excited that someone like a newspaper had written about the web series. Yeah. So that was so early on that we sort of realized that it was not a intentional. It wasn't like Alana and I sat down and we were like, let's make a feminist right. web series. It was just us being us and
yeah.
writing about, you know, what we were experiencing in our day-to-day lives and like hustle in New York and our dynamic really. And that at the time, and I think still now, is just inherently seen as feminist because mm-hmm. it's us being honest about yeah. what a woman's experience, or at least like a young white woman, white Jewish woman's experience in New York City is like. And so it so hasn't
just
ever
a reflection of
yeah it guys, hasn't ever been like
it is
a
so
thesis
personal for you guys
for
yeah.
like it's not something we like write on the wall yeah. and stick to. No, it's just yeah. I think what we try to embody, and I think we've only tried to embody that more.
Mm-hmm. In the book, you have this self-review of your own professional insecurities working on the show. And you say that almost all of them relate to you being a woman put in a position of power. What kind of things do you struggle with as a boss of your own show?
Yeah, I mean, this was something I thought a lot about on this road trip mm-hmm. because I was trying to, I was like very overworked and I realized I was a workaholic. And this partially, this road trip was me trying to take a vacation, but
yeah.
but really it was the only way I could take a vacation was to like sell a book and go on
that.
A road trip about it. And so I was like, I'm crazy. Yeah. And I was like thinking a lot about my work process, and we were editing the podcast while mm-hmm. I was on the road trip. So I was listening to cuts and I was like working the yeah. whole time, but while I was driving, and I started realizing, you know, I was thinking about, I had directed Broad City season 4 for the first time, 2 episodes. I started thinking about, even though I had found this success, like I was still insecure about all these things. And the more, you know, when I got to LA, I started writing more about it. And I realized, well, even in like these awesome opportunities I have, I still have all this doubt and insecurity.
Yeah.
And I think it does stem from just society's view of women, like mm-hmm. Like the way I was brought up, but just like when I was brought up, just how women were seen mm-hmm. and like what positions they have. And yeah. it's changing now, but it's just like it was just inherently in me of like apologizing and waiting yeah. to be ready to do something. And the directing thing really opened that up to me, because my biggest insecurity was like asking other people on set for their opinion about something. And I was like, oh, a real director wouldn't do that. And it's like, no, yet, like, that's insane. Yeah. Everyone on set is an expert at what they are there for. That's
totally.
What they're
yeah.
there for. And to act like I know everything would be completely yeah. idiotic.
Although you could be the president then.
You could be. But I have seen, actually, because I'm like Alana and I run the show, I have seen directors not ask.
Mm-hmm.
They assume, like, and it's like, I think asking is smarter. And I have to keep
yeah.
constantly remind myself that that's not a weakness. To ask mm-hmm. for help and to know you don't and shouldn't know everything is actually smarter, but it's something I have to remind myself of often. And I feel like that is because, or at least for me, I think that is an ingrained insecurity in me because I am a young woman and I'm trying to like overcome that.
Yeah. And I mean, we already teach people never to ask questions and to always have the answers and never stick your neck out. So, yeah, it must be even harder as a woman because, you know, what is the stereotype? A woman has a prerogative to change her mind and, you know, that kind of
yeah,
nonsense.
Yeah. And it's just like, yeah. I mean, I write also about how this, like, it's okay. There's like mediocre. There's so much mediocrity in the workplace.
Mm-hmm.
But if you like, there's, you can't be a successful woman and be mediocre.
Yeah.
I don't think. I think yeah. you need to, and that's the fear of showing yeah. any weakness, because if you are mediocre, you will not rise.
Yeah. Yeah, I had Tina Brown on, I don't know, a few weeks back, and she said the same thing. She said, to succeed in this world, a woman has to be gold standard in a silver job.
Yeah.
You said that you had to have a book deal to do this whole road trip. In some ways, it's the least spontaneous road trip ever. You had to have some kind of a paycheck on the back end somewhere to be able to commit to this.
It's a little sad to me. It was less about, I mean, listen, there's a paycheck, but it was less about the paycheck for me and more about the, like, a project.
Mm-hmm.
So I could have gone and just then tried to sell the book, but I don't know why, in like this fever dream while we were editing season 4, this break was looming for me. I had a 3-week break, which is a very long break for most people, but and for me was extremely long, but it was like this break that I had never had.
Uh-huh.
And so I was due to be out here in LA in 3 weeks to do this, to work on Disenchantment, which is this animated show
great
that I
show.
Voice,
Netflix.
And I was going to be recording out here. And I had been heartbroken for most of the year in 2017, mm-hmm. heartbroken and overworked. And I was like, oh my gosh, there's going to be these 3 weeks where I'm not working. That's terrifying. What will I do? And then I had a car in New York, and I was like, well, what if I drove to LA? Like, that would be incredible. I've never gone on a road trip. I've never seen the country in this way. I can't just like do that. I have to. I've been wanting to write essays in longer format. And I was like, okay, what if I just like pitch this book? That would really make it worth, like, that would make it doable and not put too much pressure on me emotionally of taking a break, but would move the pressure on to work again. And so I just, when in New York, there was a week of me before editing and after editing, I would pitch to all these publishers. And that's not how a book is sold usually.
Right. You have, at least have an outline usually.
Yep, you do. I'm admitting that is not how it's done usually. I basically had all these meetings and just, I had a one sheet where I wrote this up, but I basically told them how I was feeling, told them about this heartbreak, about my work ethic and why I was a workaholic and what I wanted to write about and how I had no idea what would happen on this road trip.
Did you feel that the publisher really was buying into this, or do you feel like perhaps there might have been some kind-hearted soul at the top of Grand Central Publishing who was just like, this girl desperately needs to take a break or she's going to go nuts. Let's just give her a book deal for her own good.
I mean, that would be so nice if people did that, but I don't think people do that.
Yeah, no.
I think they were like, which is incredible. I think they, Suzanne O'Neill, who's my editor, felt like I would figure it out,
mm-hmm.
and was kind of the person that was like along the ride with me the whole time, and had faith that I would figure this out. Because I wasn't sure of the framework until, you know, I wrote it from August when I arrived in LA, August to August, and I really figured out the framework of the book. You know, there's a lot of in-depth, more vulnerable essays, and that was sort of what I pitched. But then I realized along the way, like, I was driving so much. There's all this in-between time, in between cities, and that's where in the book there's all these lists.
Yeah.
And that was while I was driving. Those are sort of the things that go through your head where I was just thinking about all this stuff. And so I call them drive time essays. So it's like from Memphis to Austin, it's like there's a list of a topic of what I thought. And so when I found that framework, I really felt like it allows the reader to feel like they're on the trip with me.
We're going to take a quick break, and then I'll be back with more with Abby Jacobson when we come back in just a minute. Did you know that 43% of college graduates are underemployed, working jobs that don't even require a college degree? Imagine if one of the most significant investments of your life, your college degree, only worked half the time. A refund is the least you'd expect. With courses in software engineering, data science, and UX/UI design, Flatiron School stands behind its students with a tuition money-back guarantee.
Flatiron offers graduates a career services program with career coaches and ongoing learning. Students who follow every step of the plan and don't get a qualifying tech job offer within 6 months of graduating are eligible for a full tuition refund. See the complete details at flatironschool.com/terms. With graduates at hundreds of leading tech companies, the Flatiron School program is working. Full and part-time programs are available online and at Flatiron School campuses around the world. Join the school that's reinventing education, starting with student outcomes. Learn more at flatironschool.com/kickass. Again, that's flatironschool.com/kickass. In today's age, it can be hard to find the time to sit down and learn, especially when the likes of social media can be so addictive and time-consuming. So you may think that you don't have the time to read a book or to develop yourself. Well, think again. Blinkist is the only app that condenses thousands of nonfiction books into the best key takeaways and need-to-know information, so you can read or listen to them in just 15 minutes. 8 million people are using Blinkist right now, and it has a massive and growing library from self-help, business and health to history books. I read a lot of books for interviews on this podcast, and that takes up a large part of my day. But with Blinkist, I can get the most important points of a book, which prepares me for my interviews in less time, and really makes me a more intelligent, informed, and healthy me. Plus, I'm an auditory learner, so being able to listen with Blinkist suits me perfectly. They have a long list of books available. I used Blinkist to reacquaint myself with a real classic over the holidays, Dale Carnegie's How to Win Friends and Influence People. And then I listened to the number one bestseller, Fire and Fury, Inside the Trump White House by Michael Wolff. And right now, for a limited time, Blinkist has a special offer just for my audience. Go to Blinkist.com/kick to start your free 7-day trial. That's Blinkist, spelled B-L-I-N-K-I-S-T, Blinkist.com/kick to start your free 7-day trial. One more time, that's Blinkist.com/kick. And now, back to the podcast. Now, you mentioned that you were getting over a breakup.
Yeah.
I want to say that you say that in the book that it was the longest relationship that you had had at that point. So there was also this emotional and healing component to the whole trip. Talk a little about that.
Yeah, that was probably the most vulnerable part to write about, because I had always felt I'm 34 right now, and I was 32, 31. Mm-hmm. And I had always felt like this outsider because I'd never been in love before. And it was like this very shameful feeling of like, I'm not experiencing this thing that everyone seems to be experiencing. Everything is about this thing that I'm incapable of this. But it was just this like, it felt like this secret of like, oh, I can't feel this deeply about someone. Mm-hmm. Or someone can't feel this deeply about me. And then when I actually met someone and was in this relationship, it was incredible. And I was like, well, I get it. I got it now, everybody.
Get what all the fuss is
and
about.
It was also with a woman, and I'd only dated men up until this point. So it was right. A lot for me. And then it was sort of abruptly over, which was a lot in a different way for me. And I'm very thankful for that experience because 2017 and then after, you know, the writing of this book, which took place a lot in 2018, was me really going into myself and figuring out, I think heartbreak allows you to learn a lot about yourself because you're trying desperately to like figure out what happened, what went on. And I think that was also, I just was like, I don't know why I need to write this, but in getting the book deal and making this project, like I had to be accountable. Like this company was waiting on this thing. And so I had to examine myself in this way. And that's what I had pitched. So it was sort of like, I don't know why I did that, but I did it to force myself to really go in and write about myself in this way. And also, I felt like I needed to do that to differentiate myself from the character on the show, because yeah. I'm very much defined by her, and she is a lot of me, but is a younger version of me, this amplified version of me. And in writing in this more vulnerable way, I just needed personally, it was a very selfish endeavor to explore myself differently.
Yeah, what is that like? Because you and Alana kind of play heightened versions of yourself at a different age on the show. Do you have fans who just immediately assume that you are your character, or maybe even approach you in a more familiar way than they would someone else because they think that you're friends, they have some kind of a relationship with you?
Yeah, I mean, I write about this a little bit. I don't know what it's like for other people who mm-hmm. are on shows. Mm-hmm. But I do think that Alana and I, because it is so familiar, like even playing them is so, it is so close to us, but it's the most flattering thing in the world to have people think they know you. That's the ultimate goal of writing a show
yeah.
of characters, to feel real.
Yeah.
But it is, it is jarring to have people think they know you when you're living your life, mm-hmm. because I think I've developed this skill, which is to forget about that when I'm living my life. So I'm so often like confused and surprised. Like I repress the idea that I'm on a show. I don't know if I've done it on purpose, but I'm just like trying to like be out in the world living. And then someone will be like, Abby. And yeah. I immediately assume it's someone that I know.
Right.
And then it's like, oh yeah. Right. Like it's, and yeah. I think it's good that it's that way, but it's very, I don't know what the right word is. Mm-hmm. It's a bizarre, bizarre thing.
Yeah.
But it's also so flattering, but it is confusing, because I'm like, yeah. who? I'm not actually that person, but I share the name, you know, it's a lot.
When you went on this road trip, you always, I'm sure, have lots of people giving you recommendations. If you go here, you got to do this and this and this. Uh-huh. You took all the recommendations and just threw them out the window.
Yeah.
There wasn't some point in 3 weeks of introspection that you just wanted to like kind of be frivolous and do something touristy?
You know, I did do some touristy things. Like I went to the Georgia O'Keeffe Museum.
Oh, right.
And a couple of things for sure. But yeah, I write about in the book that I didn't do really any of the things you're supposed to do yeah. in any of the places I went. And when I went on the trip, that was not intended. I was intending on doing a lot of these things.
Oh, yeah.
But the more I drove, the more I realized this trip was just about me needing this space and time. And it didn't matter mm-hmm. that I saw these things. And there was this pressure for some reason of checking these things off the list, because we're living in this social media era where it's like, if you go here and you don't post a picture of that thing, you didn't really go.
Yeah.
And it's like, what are we? I didn't want that. And I did post photos
but
it wasn't of the things. It was almost the more in retrospect, looking at what I did, I was like, I hardly did anything. I just wandered around these places because that's exactly what I needed mm-hmm. to do. And that's sort of, spoiler alert, it's not a spoiler alert really at all, but that's sort of what I came to realize about this trip. There is not some grand ending. Like, you need to do these things sometimes and have it go exactly as meandering mm-hmm. as it needs to.
Yeah.
And that's okay. Like, I write that's okay a lot because it needed to be okay.
Yeah, it sounds like you really had to kind of feel the pain of what you were going through to get on the other side of this. And it's interesting that you didn't want to, you know, have a buddy along with you on the road trip. You wanted to be alone, but it sounds like you had kind of mixed feelings about that at times, especially I'm thinking of when you were in Asheville, North Carolina. You stayed at a B&B, and that's kind of the last place that you go when you want to be alone.
I mean, that was the first place I went to, and I was like, huh, right. Like, what am I doing? Because you have this romanticized idea of places.
Yeah.
And then when you get there, sometimes you're not, it's just not what you thought, or it is exactly what you thought, and you remembered, wait, yep,
yeah,
I did not want that.
It's all couples.
I'm actually very, and maybe Tua is one of my biggest flaws. I'm very independent, and that I like solitude. I don't know if it's a flaw, but sometimes it gets in my way a little bit. I like solitude a lot. I like doing things by myself quite a bit. So actually driving across the country with someone gives me a lot of anxiety. I don't know I don't know who I could do that with.
It is a lot of pressure.
Yeah. And so I was very excited to be by myself, but you know, I'm also someone who's very neurotic in that. And that's, this book is very much me being vulnerable about that. Like, I don't think that you can have a thought without having the flip. Like the op, like while I love being by myself, I often think about why.
Yeah.
Maybe I should, you know, like I think it's important to weigh the other side.
Uh-huh.
And that was a big part of this road trip, but then also why I'm a workaholic, why I haven't been in a relationship, you know, so it all sort of went together.
How about Sedona? You went to Sedona and tried all the woo stuff, the aura readings and meditation and all that. I've never been, but I've heard about it.
Sedona is beautiful. It's red rocks, which it's very much worth seeing. It's this landscape that is very different than anywhere else.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm very happy I went, but it's a very spiritual town. And I did, the aura reading was something that a lot of people said I had to do. And so it was one of the things that I did do, but I was like, what is this bullshit? Like, I don't believe that. Like, we'll see. And the whole experience in this crystal shop where I went to get this aura reading was just ridiculous. Like, I was like trying to be open-minded about it. And then this woman led me into this, what was a closet. With no door, with like an old Dell computer that was going to take my aura reading, which I was like, what are we doing? Like in my head, I was like, no, what? Like I at least thought it was going to be a film camera or like a real old timey something. And it was not. It was on a computer with like a Velcroed camera on the top. And I was like, this is just not real. But I am so non-confrontational that I couldn't leave, and I had already paid. Like, and so I stayed, and I ended up doing this whole aura reading, and the whole time I was just in my head, like, this is such a hoax. Like, and the woman, I sat down to do this aura reading with this woman, and I write about this in more depth in the book. And the first thing that she says to me is, "Okay, before we begin, I'm going to invite Jesus in to the reading with us." And I, in my head, I was like, okay. Yeah.
And you are Jewish.
I'm Jewish. And I'm whatever. I was like, geez, okay. Whatever you got to do, fine. We're here. I'm already doing this. And then it began, and she said, like, she said, very true things to me, and I started crying too, like, and really? I was trying to fight it so hard, and it was like a very bizarre experience.
She got it right, huh?
She got it right, and I was very hesitant to, like, I didn't tell her anything about myself. I feel
in that situation. What? I tried to give them nothing.
Don't give them anything, because there are things you can say to all of us, like as if she had said, "There's something missing." You feel. Yeah. I feel like you feel like there's something missing, or you're looking for something. Yeah. It's like, we all are.
Trip.
Yeah, we all are. And it was specific to me.
Interesting. So, are you a convert now?
I'm not a convert, but I do like experimenting with that stuff. I think it's kind of fun.
Yeah.
Every once in a while, I'll read a horoscope just to be like, let's see. You know, I don't do these things often, but I have an open mind about them.
Yeah. Were there parts of this trip that were kind of a culture shock for you? Because here you are, a Jewish woman from New York who dates men and women.
And I would say like queer is usually like a good word. Yeah,
there
we
go. Queer. Did you have much interaction with that segment of the country that maybe didn't vote for Hillary Clinton? Or were you ever at all uncomfortable in places where maybe they weren't as diverse as you're used to?
Like, of course, I definitely was in those places, but I didn't specifically go to cities where I felt that overwhelming opposition.
Yeah.
You know, I was in like Austin and
Marfa.
I was in like the more western places like Santa Fe and Utah. Those places were I also wasn't trying to engage in that way.
Mm-hmm.
I had felt such an overwhelming you know, season four of Broad City, we were really leaning into commenting on politics and what was going on and how we were feeling.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And I was specifically kind of trying to get away from that. I mean, I was still listening to like The Daily is my favorite podcast. No offense.
Oh, yeah. No,
but
I
listened to that every day and I was still reading The Times and like and other news outlets along the way, but lessening it to try and get away. So I also wasn't engaging in that as much.
Yeah.
So I didn't see as much as I probably could have or should have. I did notice in Texas for sure, like open carry signs.
Oh yeah.
Which is always so bizarre.
Yeah.
And scary.
Didn't you go to a Mormon lodge where all the women who worked there were dressed up in those Little House on the Prairie outfits?
I did, and I felt that actually was like tricky. I didn't mean to be disrespectful in my writing about that.
Yeah,
I hope I was not.
I
hope I was not. But
you acknowledged that you were a little bit of a fish out of water.
Yes, it was very much. I realized this is a Mormon state. For the most part. And yeah, so that was, but it wasn't culturally, I didn't stay there long enough to experience the culture. I was, that was the one stop where I felt very nervous and alone.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You mentioned a moment ago, the politics of season four. In some amazing feat, you somehow managed to snag Hillary Clinton, the ultimate guest star for Broad City. During the election, you got her on the show. How the hell did you pull that off?
To be honest, we wrote it without needing her to be like,
okay.
We never actually thought that she was going to be on the show. Alana was going to intern at her campaign office and that was going to be it.
Yeah.
Because Hillary Clinton's not going to be on our show. So it wasn't fully written that way. But we just thought Alana Wexler working at Hillary's campaign office and us getting to talk about how people are calling in, asking if Hillary's a witch and that kind of stuff would be hilarious and something that was interesting to write about.
Mm-hmm.
What we imagined people called about a woman running for president, Hillary or not. And it was so interesting. Cynthia Nixon is the campaign manager in Hillary's office who ended up
running for governor.
Yeah, which was so cool. And
it
was just very cool to get to work with her.
What was she like? I mean, it's hard to imagine a politician kind of being totally down for the vibe of your show and just
Hillary
going Hillary.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, just going balls to the wall with everything.
So, yeah. And so then once we wrote we were getting closer to production. And I think actually we shot Hillary's scene way after the season was shot. It was like shot a couple months later on its own. So we had finished the season shooting it. And she, you know, I think it was a lot of her campaign workers, obviously, who watched the show.
Mm-hmm.
And they thought it'd be a good idea for her. And we did too. And she was there for probably an hour, which is how long she should be there. Like, she shouldn't be there all day. She's got more important things to do. And it was honestly just lovely.
Yeah.
She was so sweet and generous with her time and funny. And she is, we, Alana and I were like, we're going to go nuts in like just to you.
Yeah.
Like that's what's going to happen. And there was a script, but hardly, because we just go crazy in her face. And she's just she is just truly laughing at us.
Yeah.
And it was lovely. And she was so kind. And I remember she was just like, you guys seem like you're having so much fun.
Mm-hmm.
And
she's probably envious on some level.
Yeah. I mean, it was, I'm sure it's such a different environment for her to be in. And it was like, I'm sure it was like a break.
Yeah.
And it was really a special experience.
What a drag it must be to be a politician. Even the ones who do SNL, you know that they're riding this thin line where I want to be funny, I want to please the audience and all that, but there's only so much that I can do. And politicians and comedy just don't mix.
No.
And this was one of the rare cases that it did.
And it was like, she's, you know, she didn't have to be like this hilarious thing on the show, this bit. It was just her being there and us reacting to her was enough.
And it worked.
And that she was down to do that. And it also was, I mean, the show, we always are trying to make the show funny first, but it also has a huge level of sincerity and heart. And that's all we were trying to do with having her on and having it be about just these girls being in awe of an icon.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what it was for. It was very meta. I mean, the whole crew was like, this is special that we're allowed to be with this person for an hour, you know?
Did you get much flack from the Bernie people after that?
Without a doubt.
Yeah.
We are like a reason that Trump won. And it sucks because it's not like, I mean, no way anti-Bernie. I'm very pro-Bernie.
Sure.
Just at the time, I felt like Hillary was just more like the most qualified candidate to ever run. And I was just in that camp at the time.
Yeah.
But I was pro everything Bernie, you know, like it.
Yeah.
It's very...
it's just, you know, people are being categorized all,
exactly.
all over again.
And
same thing.
We still do.
Yeah. Well, you know, toward the end of the book, you play through these scenarios of what might happen if you ran into your ex in L.A. And like we said, the whole process was you trying to get over her and move on with your life over these 3 weeks. Have you talked to her since then? Have you reached closure? Have you forgiven her? Where are you with all this? I mean, I assume she's probably read the book by now.
Don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know if she has. I don't know. I don't want to like get into that too much because it's not really about her like this, but it's really
about
me.
You getting through it.
And that chapter is actually one of my favorites because it's so amplified. And you mentioned that you listen to audiobook and you hear it more in the audiobook, me going nuts.
Yeah.
And I think that's one of the most relatable things. I think everyone feels like, well, when am I going to see them? What do I look like? What will they look like? These scenarios.
Yeah.
And I mean, all I could say about me personally is like, it's fine now, I guess.
Yeah.
I don't know exactly. Yeah, I think it's fine.
I think that's what you say at the end. You say it's okay.
It's okay.
It's
okay. And I'm like, I don't feel, I guess I'm not as, I'm not as high or low about it as I was when I wrote it. I think that stuff, if it had meaning in the relationship, then it will always have meaning when you're not.
Yeah.
I think so. Yeah.
There's a great quote at the end. You say, the things that we're most afraid of are the things that will most change you. What was that for you? And how do you feel about it now looking back?
Yeah. I mean, I think for me, allowing myself to... like give myself to someone else, like to share myself, actually be in love with someone else and in a relationship was something that I was terrified of. Like I was just very, I would end relationships and I just couldn't do it. And that was something I was just terrified of. I think and then it had completely changed like my whole makeup. And then writing about it was so terrifying. And I think doing that has completely changed me too. And I think moving forward for the most part, I really want to, you know, now that Broad City's ending, I really want to try and focus on following that.
Yeah.
I think doing things that scare you mean
it's the only way to
you
grow.
Should go. Those are the things. That's like the light.
Yeah.
It's like, well, does this scare me? And if it doesn't really, then I don't know if it's worth doing.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, once again, the book is called I Might Regret This, Essays, Drawings, Vulnerabilities, and Other Stuff. And the final season of Broad City begins January 24th on Comedy Central. Abby Jacobson, thanks so much for talking with
me. Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks again to Abby Jacobson for coming on the show. Order her new book, I Might Regret This, Essays, Drawings, Vulnerabilities, and Other Stuff on Amazon or wherever books are sold. Keep up with Abby on Twitter at Abby Jacobson, and don't miss the final season of Broad City beginning January 24th on Comedy Central. In today's age, it can be hard to sit down and learn. You may think you don't have the time to read a book. Well, think again. Blinkist is the only app that condenses thousands of nonfiction books into the best key takeaways, so you can read or listen to them in just 15 minutes. Right now, for a limited time, Blinkist has a special offer just for my audience. Go to Blinkist.com/kick to start your free 7-day trial. That's Blinkist, spelled B-L-I-N-K-I-S-T. Blinkist.com/kick to start your free 7-day trial. Once more, that's Blinkist.com/kick. Flatiron School is reinventing education, starting with student outcomes. With courses in software engineering, data science, and UX UI design, Flatiron School stands behind its students with a tuition money-back guarantee. Learn more at flatironschool.com/kickass. That's flatironschool.com/kickass. If you haven't already, be sure to subscribe to Kickass News on iTunes and leave us a review. You can follow us on Facebook or on Twitter at Kickass News Pod. And as always, I welcome your comments, questions, and ideas at comments@kickassnews.com. I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kickass News. Kickass News is a trademark of Mathis Entertainment, Inc.